we're going to be talking about the Trident demonstration that we had all gone to in Seattle last weekend. And just a little introduction to what happened the days we were gone. Saturday we had gone to there were classes that we had gone to on nonviolence. It was some training sessions. And not everybody was required to go to these classes. Someone could show up at the demonstration and just participate in the rally and not learn anything, not have to participate in any of the activities. But it was a help, we felt, even though we weren't going to be committing civil disobedience, going over the fence and being arrested, for us to understand more about the theories and the practices of civil disobedience. So Saturday was more of a preparation for the demonstration. And Sunday was the formal demonstration where we met in the morning at a farm a mile down the road from the Bangor submarine base. And after that rally, we marched 3,000 people, all of us marched down the road to the base. And it was considered a parade. We had a parade permit to be walking on one half of the road so that it was legal from that standpoint. And then everyone converged near the gate of the Trident submarine base. And those that were willing to commit civil disobedience, were willing to be arrested, stayed within the gate area, and others passed on down the line so that we were not on the base's property. We were on public, or I don't know, it would just be like being on the side of a highway. There was no problem with that being against the law. And then at that Sunday, apparently three people in the late evening had jumped over the fence or had gone over the fence, and that was premature to what the plan of the whole demonstration was. It was understood by everyone that on Monday, everyone that wanted to would walk over the fence and become arrested, be arrested at that time. So essentially, Sunday was just setting up the demonstration in the gate area of the Trident base, and other people will be talking about the Peace Conversion City that was set up there, that was proposing alternatives to Trident. And then Monday, okay, so that was Sunday. On Monday we came back, many people came back, those that were committing civil disobedience spent the night in the gate area, and the others were back at the farm, and they came in early that morning. At 9 o'clock, most of the people who were committing civil disobedience went over the fence. So that's kind of the format of what happened on those 3 days. The rest of Monday was just, people milling around in that area, and then we had gone on in the afternoon. First of all, before we go on with any of our presentations, Katie would like to read a poem, is it? A story, a poem, called The Box.
It's called The Box. It was recorded by John Denver. And I didn't get the original writer. Once upon a time, in the land of Hushabye, around about the wondrous days of yore, I came around a box, bound up with chains and locked with locks, and labeled, "Kindly do not touch, it's war." Decree was issued round about, with all a flourish and a shout, the mascot lightly tripping on before. Don't fiddle with this deadly box, or break the chains, or pick the locks, and please don't ever play with war. Well, the children understood, the children happened to be good, around the time of yore. They didn't try to play with war. Mommies didn't either, sisters, aunts, grannies neither. They were quiet and sweet and pretty in those wondrous days of yore. Well, very much the same as now, they weren't the ones to blame somehow for opening up that deadly box. But someone did. Someone battered in the lid and spilled the insides out upon the floor. A sort of bouncy, bumpy ball made up of the guns and flags and all the tears of horror and the death that goes along with war. It bounced right out and bashed into everything in store. And what was sad and most unfair is that it didn't seem to care much who it bumped or why or what or for. It bumps the children mainly, and I'll tell you this quite plainly. It bumps them every day and leaves them dead and burned and dying, thousands of them sick and crying, because when it bumps, it's really very sore. Now there's a way to stop that ball. It isn't very hard at all. All it takes is wisdom. I'm absolutely sure that we could get it back into the box and bind the chains and lock the locks. No one seems to want to save the children anymore. Well, that's the way it all appears, because it's been bouncing around for years and years, in spite of all the wisdom whiz since those wondrous days of yore. From the time they came across the box, drawn up with chains and locked with locks, and labeled, "Kindly do not touch, it's war."
We'll introduce what we're each going to be talking about, and then we'll just go on from there in each talk.
I'm just going to tell kind of the history and reasons, and history of the movement itself also. Let me go on this one, or just go.
Why don't we each say what I think that'd be helpful to get along with you.
And I'm going to talk about Saturday, the nonviolence training class that we went to, and what happened, okay.
I'm going to discuss kind of Sunday and Monday. And one thing I want to say, too, is anytime anybody has any questions, just speak up, because, you know, if we're not talking about anything that people want to hear, then we'll change. So, you know, just say something if you have questions or anything.
I'm going to talk about Peace Conversion City and nonviolence and civil disobedience as a way of life.
Now I'm going to be talking about the media as it relates to this, the Trident issue, just how it was treated, how most people know about the Trident demonstration through the media.
Okay. 3,000 to 4,000 people gathered last weekend to demonstrate the Trident nuclear submarines at the Bangor, Washington Naval Base. And there were a lot of different reasons for participating and for people getting that upset about it, about Trident. The cost was one consideration because there are 13 immediately planned submarines and 30 projected. Each one of them will cost $2.3 billion, which is enough to fund the Seattle School District for 22 years or University of Washington for 15 years, or to build 33 Seattle kingdoms, or probably to run Holden Village for the ever. another reason is for the nuclear threat. On each submarine, there are 408 deliverable nuclear warheads, each independently targeted. Each one of those warheads is five times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. Last week, Elizabeth figured out how many times you could blow up Hiroshima if you did it for every day, and it was
72 years.
Yeah, it was just amazing. Okay.
What's that?
The power of Hiroshima. You could blow up Hiroshima every day for 72 years, and that would be the power of one submarine.
Another reason is that the total number of other strategic and tactical weapons, there's enough weaponry without Trident to destroy every available target. The United States can destroy every available target 50 times over. Another reason is to reorient society so that it is based on peacetime production and not war preparation, however idealistic that may sound. probably more important reason is the morality of this first offensive weaponry. Trident represents a dramatic change in U.S. nuclear weapons policy, because up to this point, all weaponry was considered defensive, whether or not it could be, you know, could be used offensively, but it was considered defensive. Trident is accurate to within 90 feet, and one of the chief engineers, Robert Aldrich, admitted that it was designed for first strike capability, and as such, it is in violation of many international treaties. The Nuremberg principles specifically note that it is a crime for any citizen of any state to fail to resist the preparation or the carrying out of aggressive wars. A week ago, Wednesday, Ann Cohan read that letter from Carol Witte, and the booklet on Trident was enclosed, and a bunch of people were kind of concerned about that. And after a community meeting, a couple things were raised that kind of made it a little more close to home. One was that because Trident has first strike capability, Bangor would be a number one target for Russians and others. It would, if that were to be a target, it would, all that nuclear power would destroy Seattle, Tacoma, Olympia, Victoria, and Vancouver. It was also brought to our attention that if that were to occur, people at Holden Village at the time would have to go into the mines or into the mine or the lockers in the dining hall for 21 days. It was also, I think Karen mentioned that, you know, with all that nuclear force, might Copper Mountain cave in with all those?
Or the lockers.
Yeah, well, you know, that too. Because the Copper Mountain is so hollowed. I don't know. It kind of made it a little scarier. I don't know. Trident history began in 1967 when Pentagon began a contest for designing the ideal weapon, and Trident won. This proposal was made public in 1971, and in 1972, the Armed Services Committee voted against producing Trident. And Senator Henry Jackson of Washington was an influential member on that committee, and he voted against it. But when it was amended to be based in Bangor, Washington, he changed his mind. In 1973, it was barely approved by the Senate 49-47. It was supposed to be made ready this year, but because of cost and production difficulties, it would be available in 1981. However, this past month, Trident missiles were fitted onto the now soon to be obsolete Poseidon series of submarines. The history of the resistance began in the early 70s when there were first attempts to bring it to public attention, and there were court cases against it environmentally, but they were abandoned because they were ineffective. In 1975, Pacific Life Community was formed along with other groups across the nation to protest against things like this. Personal resistance, characterized by nonviolent direct action civil disobedience, was a primary way in which these life communities expressed their opposition to Trident. In spring 1977, Trident Concern Coalition was formed because at that time in order to give a Trident Concern week, and after that week the group was changed to Live Without Trident, which is the group that kind of sponsored this past demonstration.
It's not just based in Seattle. It's like it's a national group.
Yeah.
There's the same day that there was a demonstration at Bangor, there was also a demonstration in California, in Washington, D.C., in New York, and there's seven different places. So it was a national effort on that same, this two-day effort.
The first kind of demonstration was in August 1977 when 2,000 demonstrated at the base, but this was not, did not involve any civil disobedience, it was just a demonstration. From this they organized the May 22nd coalition, and on May 22nd, 1978, 6,000, this was the largest, came to the base and to protest the building of Trident and also the continuation of arms buildup. And at that time, 300 were arrested, but eventually only 181 were convicted. Education and communication have continued, and October 28th coalition, and just a couple days ago, that demonstration occurred, and only three to 4,000, less than the last one, were involved, and 109, I think, was the last number, were arrested.
Do you want to, any questions?
Yeah.
Yeah. How, what's the difference between first strike capability and not having first strike capability? How can someone say, unlike missiles that we have and things buried in the ground in South Dakota and what have you, this one is first strike?
Because it can be targeted to within 90 feet, whereas the other
ones... And the others only intercept missiles that are coming at us, or what? Can't they be targeted also?
But it's a much broader range, and for that reason they're not considered. I don't know what the difference is, but it's
John,
a much...
John, the thing is that Trident couldn't be used as a defense. The whole idea about Trident is that you hit the other guy before he can press the button. If there's going to be an all-out blowout, the only reason you use Trident is so that you can hit the Russians' core, the Russians' center of operations, or whoever it would be, before they could even press their button. Because, and also the accuracy of 90 feet means that it will then, if they can tune it in to the Russians' big bogey, whatever it is, they can destroy their warhead at the same time. And so there'll be nothing for them to send over to us. No, it isn't even defensive, it's just,
I'm
going to bash you before I can
bash me. Whose definition is that, though?
Mm-hmm. That was someone there. We asked.
Yeah, but I mean, is that the group that is against Trident that's defining it that way to give them, you know, more...
As first strike capability?
Yeah.
No, the chief designer said that it was first strike capability.
I think I've read that, and they admit that, but is that... That doesn't admit that it is not, that it could not be also defensive. I mean, there's no...
They wouldn't say that, but what's the point of making it so accurate?
If you're going to spend $23 billion, you might as well hit the nail right on the head.
Anyway, it's
destructive
anyway. Why bother?
Yeah.
Anyway, you have to spend much more to make it
that
accurate.
Yeah.
So that's the point.
Even for a defensive, the 90 feet or an accurate weapon is much better than a non-accurate weapon. And it is used as a deterrent. If I was going to attack the United States, I think I'd think twice about it if I could destroy every land base missile system that's coming at me.
See, if the only thing we have to do is blow up a city, I assume we don't have to hit within that accuracy. I mean, we can miss by 5 miles and still kill everybody. Mm. I mean, it's merely deterrent force. It would seem we wouldn't have to be that accurate. I think, you know, the point of accuracy would be that you actually can wipe out the possibility of striking us.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if it's merely to kill everybody, we can already do that. We can already do that without trying. Is the way I hear it.
Yeah.
Been in times over.
In a sense, it is defense because of the potential power of Trident. No one would, the theory is that no one would attack, or there would not be an attack because of that.
I think one of the ideas behind Trident, though, is that it's so portable, it can't be wiped out, because it'll be out there in the middle of nowhere, and they won't know where it's at.
We've had Polaris submarines for 10 or 15 or 20 years. Trident doesn't offer anything new on that line. We've had nuclear submarines bombing around with atomic warheads for years. Why do we have to spend $2.5 billion per submarine for this? I think the first strike point is well taken. Seems to me that's precisely what it's for.
Liz, where were you reading? You mentioned a number of facts. You never stated quite clearly where you got those facts, such as the Trident subs. Because I've read information that is quite different from what you just said, as to the price of the Trident sub.
Within the Trident handbook, and they have that footnoted with the deals.
I don't know if the news media.
Why don't we also keep in mind, assuming that those figures are somewhat correct, $2.5 billion. Well, the Defense Department isn't spending that money in Russia. It's also being spent right here in the United States. People are going to work, supporting their families with that money. It's not money completely, totally wasted.
Why not?
You might think I'm coming down on this thing a little heavy, but
I'll come on to that. I have a big counsel with you later. I'll be
okay.
Yeah, Werner. But I think it is important though, to fight an issue like overarming and so forth. That that information is accurate and not so biased that it's counterproductive. That's why I was questioning, who really has designated it as the first strike capability. Now, just because the engineer designed it, there's no one engineer that designed that particular missile system. Now, if he has gone anti-nuclear, well, then I would say that, to me, that's not really good information to convince me that it's a negative. I mean, for me to get on the bandwagon to fight against Trident. Same way with the comment about Henry Jackson. I know he's capable of changing his mind for the good of Washington, but the implication was that just because they put it in Washington, he did change his mind. Now, I guess I would hope that he had another reason, or that I would have put more stock in what you said by saying that, just not because he put it in Washington that he voted for it. I think that's sort of a shallow reason to even state. I think it would have been better not to state that in defense of, getting rid of Trident.
Mm-hmm. First strike capability, I don't think there's many weapons that haven't been made that you couldn't say that they did have a first strike capability. And to base the entire thing on that, I don't know if it's there. Like John's saying, I don't know if there's a lot of weapons we have that have been here for years that have that.
Not with such power. I mean, okay, you can push a button or send a bomb over before somebody else. But the point about Trident is that because it's incredibly accurate and incredibly powerful,
and mobile,
it's going to destroy their retaliation. So the whole idea is to get there first.
They have the same capability, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
We
have to destroy their capabilities before they can push the button.
Wouldn't it make more sense to...
So that is a defensive mechanism, though.
The whole reason behind...
Yeah, well, it's both.
The whole reason behind the accuracy is to have fewer of the weapons if you do need those type of weapons, and not to hit total cities or wipe out the whole...
Well,
space.
It'll do that, too. It'll just be very thorough.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Doesn't the whole idea seem like folly, though, because it takes hours for submarines to position themselves to send off missiles. And you're talking about first strike capability, that's exactly what it is. Because if you find out they're sending theirs over, it's already maybe too late for you to position, to strike out their position. You're talking about not minutes, but hours. Missiles to travel and submarines to position themselves. So the system like that, it's, to me, primarily offensive.
I can almost guarantee you that there's probably subs on station and they're relieving themselves and probably be able to fire those missiles momentarily.
But the missiles take a while to travel, though. How, we're not talking about
15 minutes.
15 minutes?
Here from the north. In northern Canada, the Soviet Union, Moscow, 15 minutes.
Maybe I'm getting ahead of what Jim was going to talk about, but it seems like the point is, that we're going to get to maybe is not that Trident is what we really have to fight or anything, it's just the whole kind of lifestyle and mentality behind it. So it's kind of fruitless whether we talk about whether it's defensive or offensive, really.
Yeah.
She's just getting some, maybe it's inaccurate, but information about Trident itself. I think they just picked Trident because it's a new thing that's in the news to demonstrate against. Could have been something else. I mean, as far as showing that people are for nonviolent lifestyle. Yeah.
I got the feeling a little bit that maybe if it's defensive, it's okay.
Yeah, no, that's what I don't think that's what we're talking about.
But I think what everybody kind of jumped on was they said that this is a first strike capability and that's what we're all against.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I don't think they can base the first strike capability, and probably most people around here will say that, you know, the whole moot problem is a problem with our philosophy. At least that's what I...
Well, you related this to international treaties, saying that this kind of weapon is in violation of treaties, implying that other kinds of weapons do not violate the treaties. Could you expand on that a bit? Is that part of the issue, that we've signed treaties outlawing this kind of weapon and now we're going ahead
for some obscure reason? We're allowed to have defensive weapons but not offensive weapons, which brings the whole point of Trident in again, because here we are producing now an offensive weapon when we said that we won't do that. I'm identifying myself with the Americans for the purpose of this.
How does our government surely that argument has been put to
I didn't understand how it couldn't be so blatant.
You know, that's why I ask who is designated as the first strike capability, because it's just the designer has done it. I don't think that holds any water.
Mm. I don't know, but can I suggest we move on?
Yeah.
To get to Laurie's point, but we want to talk about this more. Maybe we could come back to it if it's still an issue.
Yeah, I think more of what Jean was saying, whether it's does it make it being defense make it being okay? I got a strong impact in going to the nonviolence training session. You know, it was a 3 to 4 hour class, and couldn't imagine what they would teach for 3 to 4 hours on nonviolence. You know, it just seemed to say it all just in the title, but there was a lot of things to learn, and I was impressed with the power of it. It started out where everybody who came registered, and the people who were in charge had the names of the affinity groups, the people in it, the people who were planning on committing civil disobedience, and so that they had a record of who would be where, who was planning to be arrested, and I thought that was a organized thing, and they had a concern for the people who were doing it.
Debbie, maybe mention what affinity groups.
Yeah, I will. I'll get to that. We then moved on to the nonviolence training class, and a big emphasis of it was they weren't pushing civil disobedience. They weren't saying that, you know, we have to jump over that fence and get more people arrested so that we can make a bigger impact. They really stressed that if you weren't prepared for it or emotionally didn't feel ready for it, that it's a lot more than just hopping a fence. You know, you have to see it through, and you have to go to jail and go to trial. And so they really made a point of that. They talked about non-violent direct action. They said that it was not directed towards, it was directed towards the system and not individuals in the system. That just because we go there and demonstrate against Trident, we're not against the guards or anybody there who is working on security. It's not the people there, or it is the issue of Trident itself. And they made a point of saying that it has to begin within each of us, that nonviolence is a way of life. It has to begin within ourselves. And mass demonstration in a nonviolent way just tells the system that, yes, we can live in a nonviolent way. We can do this, and we can show it by demonstrating it. I wrote down on the board behind me, you can see, they had these hanging up on the wall, and it tells nonviolent direct action. First thing, define your objective. You know, what are your reasons for demonstrating against Trident or whatever the issue is. Be honest and open-minded that with yourself, with the people who are in your group, and with people on the other side. You know, listen to what their story is. One of the group leaders was talking about, you know, you have to understand where the guards are coming from. You know, you're there and they might act like they're treating you, you know, however they're treating you, but that you're an obstacle for them. They want to get home, they've had a long day's work, and, you know, you kind of have to understand where they're coming from. And three is love your enemies. Again, it's saying it's the issue, not the people. And to give opponents a way out, that was primarily to the people who are doing civil disobedience and to the people who, you know, are just being a part of it. You don't want to back somebody up against the wall, even verbally. It's a violent type thing to feel like someone's closing you in. The next thing they talked about were some steps on investigate, get the facts about the situation, negotiate, talk about it, educate, tell, find ways of getting the public to know about what's actually going on, and demonstrate by leafleting or mass demonstration, and also just by the way that we live in a nonviolent way. And then last, resisting, which would be civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is getting arrested on purpose, you know, to prove your point. Everybody got into affinity groups, which were like 6, 8, 10, 12 people. The affinity groups were a group just, I think, basically for order. There are just basically two kinds of affinity groups: support groups, who would just come to support, to be of support, to be a part of the number there, and then the civil disobedient groups, which are made up of some people who actually do civil disobedience and some people who are in support to them. And the people who are in support to them are, their job is to get in touch with friends, family, to tell them that they are in jail, and just to get in touch with other people who they might need to get in touch with once they're in jail. They only have one phone call. And then the next thing we went into was consensus decision making, which it's funny because we even just in talking we always do it now, and it's a good system. With consensus decision making, everybody in the group has a say, and everybody in the group feels that it's their own decision. You know, nobody is left out because you have to vote. And what it is there's an issue that's brought up, and there's different symbols. Put your thumb up means yes, I agree on that. To put your thumb down means no, I don't agree on that. And you can also put your fist in, and that means that before I make my answer, I have some reservations and I want to just find out a little bit more. And this is good in quick decision making. Everybody has a say in what's going on, and so it proves to be really good.
maybe an example of...
They gave an example, and we split up into two groups, two affinity groups, and we each had to deal with this situation they lined up for us. And they said, okay, it's Sunday afternoon, and you're at the Trident base, and you're babysitting for someone else's children who's in another affinity group, who's going to jump the fence. You see the guards coming. You have their children. What are you going to do? You know, you don't want to... The situation is you don't want to stay there because you have the children and the guards are coming. You don't want to take the chance of getting arrested. You don't want to jump the fence till tomorrow, so what do? So you get together as a group and you all say, well, I suggest that we take the children and go back over the line where we can't get arrested. And everyone who thinks that's a good idea puts their thumb up, their thumb down, or their fist out if they have another idea. And you can make a quick decision. And you see, you know, that everybody says, yes, okay, that's a good idea. So it seemed to work well.
It seems like it's cumbersome having everyone having to agree, but it worked out where there was, we reached consensus, even in 2 minutes. On an issue that was difficult to resolve. It seems like it can also, it works in long-term decisions and also very very short-term decisions too.
How is this different than majority rule? Are you saying you deal with it until
everyone has to agree?
Yeah.
You can't have any thumbs down or across. It needs
if somebody
to be
puts their thumb down, it blocks the whole decision. You have to make alternate suggestions or try to, talk with the person who's blocking to see if they would change their mind or find out or understand why they are, saying what they're saying. Maybe they have a good point. So you do it until there's everyone says yes. And there's really a lot of responsibility that each individual has because you don't want to block consensus just for, any reason. You want to have a good reason. So there's a lot of responsibility that each person in the group takes on because of it. They went on to talk about a little bit more about the responsibilities that you have in doing civil disobedience. They advised you that if you're going to do this, you shouldn't plead guilty. You should plead not guilty, and then they gave different reasons once the trial comes up, what you would base that on, such as trespassing to prevent a greater harm, which would be a reason, or just what Liz was saying of the Nuremberg defense, just that individuals have the right to say that they feel the country is doing something wrong.
An example of that is Martin Luther King going against the law and not being above the law, but testing the law, resisting it to prove that it is, that the law, that the understanding of the law is not quite right.
They also said that you shouldn't, that people who are committing civil disobedience shouldn't post bail, that they should stay there and stay also as long as everyone else is there, not to leave on a special condition. And we did some role plays also after that, which I have some pictures of, and we can also, which I can pass around, and we can also, if there's time after we have the session, maybe we can all do them, or a couple of them. At the end of the session, we had some brainstorming. We just shared our concerns, what we were feeling. And she wrote it all down. And people were concerned about things such as the chance of being arrested in case you didn't want to be. Well, what about if there's violence? How should we respond to the media? You know, what if there's a lack of organization? You know, what part do people play? There was a lot of fears and things. It's just natural, and it was a good thing to talk about it, and she kind of cleared a lot of them up at the end, and so it was a real well-balanced thing. I'll pass around some of these pictures to give you just an idea of what it was like. Here's a picture of the instructor telling us about the consensus decision.
She just pass them out, 'cause I'm putting them against us.
Yeah, okay. Some of them in there are the role plays that we did too. One of the, okay, go ahead.
What type of background did your trainers have? Where did they get these skills? And
okay, they had gone to, during the summer they were more complete. Nonviolence training. They were both trained for peacemakers, which are a part of different peacekeepers, which are a part of different the affinity groups. During the summer, they had a more full session, which went into it much more in depth. And they had also been involved in other Trident demonstrations.
I think it's the Live Without Trident group that established the education. And it was the training. I'm not sure who was in charge of that, but that was where the training started.
I don't want to limit the moving on to the other three people, because I think it's going to build as we go. I just want to make one point about Trident and going over the fence and nonviolent direct action or civil disobedience. It's not as clear as some others. And I think all you can say is it isn't as clear as some other civil disobedience. We moved into a segregated lunch counter. Blacks and whites ordered a Coke. That was civil disobedience. That's a very clear one. You're saying that law is wrong, and you're willing to move and with your action break the law that's wrong, and the message is very clear. You really are not, or they that went over, they are not protesting a no trespassing sign on a government fence. So it's all I can say is it's not as clear, and so it's harder to get the message out. Do you see what I mean? It isn't as though you are not guilty of trespassing, so that the action, whenever the symbol lines up with exactly what you want to say, it's easier. Gandhi had thousands of satyagrahas spinning because the British said it was illegal to spin. So you broke the law by actually spinning, which said what you really wanted to say. All I'm saying is the people who are opposed to the Trident, I just got a three-page letter from Mark Hatfield, who is opposed to SALT II because we can overkill so many times. I mean, he is anti-nuclear armament in the world, and he's still doing it at a Senate level, and he's still doing it letters. There are some people who are at the point of frustration of trying to say, when will this madness end? So Trident really is the willingness to be arrested in order that somebody hears it, because nobody's hearing it. So you choose a way in which you have a mass protest that may get the media there. Understand that, and I affirm that. But the message of going over the fence is just not as good as moving into a segregated lunch counter. So it gets confusing when you say, plead not guilty. And it's easier to say publicity hound, because to a certain extent that's true. It is a publicity hound, not for an ego trip, but because that, yeah, we want publicity. So I'll quit. I wish it were clearer, a clearer way to say what you really want to say, but I don't know any other way to do it.
Perhaps it's because it was the other laws that you were describing, John, were dealing with individuals.
Yeah.
And this is dealing with a system in relation to individuals.
It isn't a law that you're against. It's a whole That's Gemma's point. That's why I said I hesitated to break in.
On Sunday, it started out, there's a farm about a mile and a half down the road from the Trident base, and the couple who lived there allowed them to have a rally on their land. And the whole day was, we heard on the radio coming back that, you know, the media made it sound like that it didn't look like a demonstration, it looked like a circus. And I think in saying that, they were trying to negate what happened. But I think in a lot of ways, that's exactly what everyone wanted to happen. Because by being positive about it, you know, by saying peace conversion, instead of saying we're not anti-Trident, we're for peace, you know, to you know, that whole non-violence peace thing is looking at it in a different way. So the whole atmosphere of the rally was fun. You know, it looked like a rock concert, except there was a lot of things missing, like drugs, I guess. But everything else about it was the same. Where there was, it started out, there was a guy playing some music, and he had on the ground beside him two solar panels, and he said, the energy for this PA system has come from the sun. You know, that kind of stuff. There was a band called Shelley and the Crustaceans who played anti-nuclear songs. They were funny. You know, the songs were fun. Everyone was singing along. There were banners, there were balloons, you know. Everything about it seemed, you know, I could see why the media didn't know what was going on, because it didn't look like a demonstration. When the speakers got up and went outlined what we were doing and why, and went over some ground rules for the demonstration about it being a nonviolent thing, and some couple of basic rules that we went by. One was to make sure we stayed on the left side of the road, because that was where we were allowed, and also that whenever things got out of hand, if people started raising their hands, that meant to be quiet. And when she said that, you know, I thought, that's nice. And we practiced, the whole crowd made noise, and then people started raising their hands and everyone got quiet. That didn't make much sense at the time, except I thought maybe when we got up there someone would want to make a speech. But there weren't any speeches. And I'll get to that later, why that worked. Another thing was a telegram that just amazed me. It felt like this is a lot bigger thing than just us 3,000 sitting around this farm in Bangor, Washington. They got a telegram from New Zealand. It said, we're watching and waiting from halfway around the world. Your struggle is our struggle, from the Auckland Peace Coalition in New Zealand. And they sent that on the day that we were all there. You know, they knew that we were there. I don't know, it just felt really different knowing that it was so much bigger than just us. So we saw, I don't know, anybody who was here in September in the room, Laura Youngenberg. Yeah, she was there with her affinity group from Tacoma, and also the honeymoon couple, Bob and Annie Gracious, the guy with red hair and beard, they were there. Yeah, they were in the same group.
Yeah.
Bob went over the fence, and I saw his wife on Monday, and it was really, it was neat seeing her, because she was just so at peace about the whole thing. She knew what he was doing and why, and she just said, well, we'll see what happens next. The parade started then, and there were people who in the crowd were identified as peacekeepers who wore orange bands on their hats, and their job was just to make sure that things didn't get out of hand, and to make sure people stayed on the left side of the road. When we got near the base, a lot of people started yelling and chanting, Live Without Trident and different slogans like that. And I'd say less than a minute after they got started, everyone's hands shot up in the air and the crowd got quiet. And we kept walking, and it started up again, and all the hands went up again. And I think the silence of that whole group was what was the most powerful thing about it. You know, I don't know how it must have felt to those guards to realize that there were 3,000 people protesting, not saying a word. But when we went over a little bit in nonviolence training, we'd kind of come to a decision that if I were a guard, I would probably be, that would be a form of verbal violence. You know, if there are people climbing over the fence and there's people at the fence chanting at you, chances are you're not going to understand what they're saying. All you hear is people yelling at you. And if you get upset and want to take it out on somebody, you're probably going to take it out on the people climbing over the fence. And we didn't want any of that kind of stuff. So there wasn't any chanting. And some of the people in the crowd it became obvious, had not been in on the whole thing about it being a nonviolent protest. I don't want to make any comment on socialists or communists, but they were the people that I talked to who had the most problems with it being nonviolent. There were several women carrying a big banner or something about the Socialist Party, and I kind of made eye contact with one of the women right when the hands started going up, and they were the ones who kept up the yelling. And she just looked at me and said, "What is this? You know, this is really frustrating. Why can't we yell?" You know, I said, "Well, it's not, it's verbal violence. You know, the guards really get uptight when you yell at them, so we're not going to do it, you know." And I just assumed that everyone there knew what was going on, but talking to them, I realized that they didn't. And they just thought, you know, they said, "The riots in Europe are really loud and angry, and people storm the fences, you know." And I said, "Well, if the goal is to be peace, then we need to go about it in a peaceful way, you know. The means and the end have to be the same." And they pointed at the base and said, "This is violence, so we need to be violent." And I just said, "Well, I disagree." And I went and found one of the peacekeepers and said, "You know, watch these guys, because they're really good. You know, I could, it felt like they could be a real source of problems." 5 minutes later, I couldn't even see their banner. It was huge. It was, you know, this big orange banner. Apparently, they either just took it down and left, or for whatever reason, their banner wasn't up anymore. And there was, you know, then later I talked to one of the women from the communist newspaper press, and I don't remember what all we talked about, but she said how she's more in favor of a violent revolution, that nonviolence doesn't make any sense to her, that if you really want to accomplish anything, you just have to take up arms the same as they do. And it was just interesting talking to them, because they, I guess because I'd run into people like them last year at Ohio State who seemed to think that, you know, it's better to take up guns and shoot. And I just thought, well, they're the military. They have to have better guns than us. And if we play by their rules, we're going to lose. So we have to change the rules and make them play by our rules. Sunday was mostly just, you know, milling around outside the fence. No one really climbed the fence except those three guys late in the afternoon. There were some people who stayed the night there along the road. The space between the road and the fence wasn't any wider than this room at the widest point. I don't even think it was that big. It was pretty narrow, and a lot of people were crowded into a small space, and it was a long strip. Some of them camped out there who were planning on climbing the fence the next day. And we found out the next day, I don't know if some of you saw the front of Monday's paper had that big banner, said "From Trident to Life." And they'd hung it across the goal, the post in the front of it, where the drive, where you drive in. And sometime early in the morning, a bunch of guards came out. All they were going to do is take that sign down. But some of the peacekeepers who were up there saw the guards coming out and panicked and ran up and told everyone that the guards were coming. Everyone picked up all their stuff, ran across the road, and then they realized that all they were doing was taking down the banner. But that was what the peacekeeper's job was, to warn everyone. But there were people who spent the night there. Monday morning, all we heard was that the action was going to happen around 9 or 10. So we got there a little bit after 10 and found out that everyone who climbed the fence already did it at 9. So at first I was really disappointed, thinking, you know, we missed out on all the action. And then I thought, that's just how the media looks at it, that there's nothing exciting to see. You know, but just walking around and just being there all day, talking to people who had friends who climbed over the fence, it kind of, that party atmosphere was kind of there again, where no one was really upset because everyone assumed that no one was going to get hurt. You know, the guards kind of knew what was going on. It was nonviolent. So everyone was just kind of, you know, wandered around, talked to the news people. There was one guy who was in our group in nonviolence training, who, I don't know if you saw the paper on Tuesday, I think, there was a tree about 100 feet inside the fence, and he climbed up in this tree. And from up there, he had a good spot to talk to the media. And I think the best article I saw in the paper was when they quoted him. His name was Doug. And the rest of the time, Dave's going to talk more about the media reports. But I think that, you know, whenever they gave Doug a chance to talk about what he was doing and why, is what I thought was the best news articles. One of the things he said, I tried to write down everything I heard him say. He said, "I wanted to make a statement as long as I could. That's why I was in the tree. Everyone else had been arrested and taken away."
He said, but it's not for me. I didn't want the glory to draw attention to Trident. He said, my affinity group saw the tree and decided to use it. One guy fell, he had tennis shoes on, and it's really slippery. He was up there from something like 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. He also commented that he was a Christian. Later the guards came and said that they were going to spray him down with water with 200 pounds of pressure. And he said, well, I'll get down before you do that, but I'll wait till you get the hoses out. He also said he thanked the guards for being so peaceful about it, being so patient. He told he made, wanted to make sure that everyone knew he didn't hate the guards, that he really complimented them on being polite. I think if they had to pick someone to be the one in the tree, it couldn't have worked out any better, because he was such a friendly guy and was, you know, talked to the guards and stuff. The only other thing I needed to say now was that there were some people who went into, the base was kind of divided up into Area 1, 2, and 3. Area 1 was just over the fence in the main area along the main road. Area 2 was, I talked to a guy who had some people in his group who went into Area 2, and what they did was, there are other access roads to the base that aren't quite as public, but they're public roads. So they drove back one of these roads, and about 8 people from their group climbed over the fence and wanted what they wanted to do, and he didn't have any way of knowing if they made it or not at the time. But they wanted to get into one of the buildings where people were working, just like an office building or something. I guess they had aerial photographs of the base and they had an idea where they were going. Just to leaflet and to talk to people and say, look, this is important enough to us that we risked our lives coming in here. Just to make maybe a more stronger statement. The risk going in there was that they didn't know, you know, for one thing, the guards out in the front are Pan Am employees who are hired by the base, and the Marines are other military people, are the guards inside, and they didn't really know who they were going to run into going into Area 2. Area 3 would have been inside where the nuclear arms are kept, and there was really strong discouragement from anyone going in there just because you could be shot. You know, I think it would have been pretty foolish to go in there. But as far as this guy knew that they'd made it okay, he said they did, when they went over, as far as he could see him go, there was no one there. They just walked in. Does anyone have any questions?
Can you stand up and stretch? Just a bit more and then we'll move on. The idea for talking about the media as it relates to Trident came up for me in the role play when I played as a media person in our resistance. Some people jumped over the fence, some people stayed behind and were supporters, other people other people were some media people there also. And I just noticed what I was looking for in the action, in the demonstration. I was looking for fights. I was looking for just uncommon behavior. The guards treating the role players, the people that were the guards that were role playing, treating the civil disobedience people, roughly. And I just thought about how many people that are in mass media aren't very sensitive to anything but that type of view, that type of vision. There's a vision for what is loud, what is outrageous, or what is unusual. And I think that this demonstration didn't really lend itself to that type of approach. There was much more than just the guards carrying the demonstrators away. The Peace Conversion City was something that wasn't very visual. You can't really, you know, see, it's not front page stuff, but it is very powerful in another way. It's a powerful statement. Just, well, some views here, I'll take some examples from the newspapers. These are two Seattle, the Post Intelligence and the Seattle Times, I believe. And I was just struck by the way that it was portrayed. Not that they were, not that the papers were giving a false story. I just sensed that the story they were concentrating on was a story that was not in favor with the demonstrators, was very much for the military base and the public, the status quo. I'll just read from a bit of this.
Can you pass those pictures up on the slide?
Okay, this is from the Post Intelligence, and I'll just read from it. More than 100 anti-nuke fighters cavorted their way into federal custody and a date with the judge in Seattle today by jumping the fence here yesterday on the second day of the Live Without Trident demonstration. Later they were handcuffed and manacled and carted off to 7 yellow school buses. All of them, including tree-sitter Jensen, were taken to the base gymnasium to receive citations to appear before Judge Williams. Okay. And the base security police, wearing riot gear and carrying riot sticks, remained cordial and sometimes smiled and joked with the protesters. The most touching moment came when Debbie Beadle, a crippled 38-year-old woman, decided to join the civil disobedience. The Yakima woman with long blonde braids was lifted gently over the barbed wire fence by her friends. Asked if she was afraid, she said, "No, I feel good, I believe in life." She picked up her canes and hobbled onto the grass, where security guards in their almost fatherly fashion put their arms around her and escorted her to the bus. I felt that by this representation of the demonstrators that they were cute, or they were interesting, or they were in some ways entertaining. And I felt, and also just the treatment, you know, they were carted to the bus. They were less than human in some way, is my feeling about the representation that they had given. And that the guards were prepared in riot gear, but they were very cordial and friendly with the demonstrators. Yes, the fatherly leading of her to the bus. Some pictures that were in the paper, just I feel it's important to, we don't often educate ourselves at looking at pictures in the paper, looking at media, even television programs. We just take them for face value. And I sense there's something very very loud or very, what do you say, these pictures are contorting the picture, contorting the situation in some way. See, I'll hold them up. Just the yelling, like, I don't think that being there during the day, there weren't a lot of people that were yelling and protesting and acting in riotous ways. And I sense from the pictures here, like this one in particular, there's a spirit of something too high, there's a spirit of it being very rowdy. Just the orientation of the guard being very big and like just overpowered by the presentation of it. It seems that media needs to be very project very far in order to get to the mass audience. It can't be a subtle picture, it can't be a soft picture, it can't be a gentle picture of a group of people sitting together or someone handing someone handing someone else a cup of soup. Like, the mood of the day on Monday was not very violent, it wasn't very active, it wasn't dynamic, it was a very subtle, warm mood. And I don't think that came across in the media. That was not the orientation, that was not the focus of what they were looking at. It doesn't sell. It doesn't sell papers. I sense that there's, we often trust this source as a single source of what went on those days. And I sense just from looking at those these papers, if I hadn't gone there myself, I would say, well, you know, it looks as if it was a pretty it was a pretty rowdy situation, and that I would just have a different view than I do of the collective, the oneness of the group, and also the friendliness between the guards and the demonstrators. That came through, as Russ mentioned, in the story about Jensen up the tree. There was that kind of friendliness. Yeah. So I just wanted to point out, it's important for me to point out that there is a distortion of views of demonstrations and other things like this, because it's not in the interest of the paper to put forth those views. It's a difficult thing to...
Sure.
A couple.
This is what to talk about, because I feel very strongly about it. I'm not feeling very eloquent. But for me, the whole point about the Trident demonstrations was nothing really to do with Trident. The three things that came across to me were the Peace Conversion City, but you can just call it Peace Conversion. In other words, converting your country from a war-based economy to a peace-based economy. The non-violent part of it, which has impressed me most, and the idea of civil disobedience. And I'll try and talk a little bit about each of those and bring up the point that John made as I go along. Non-violence wasn't just something that we practiced while we were marching along and not talking. We were taught also in the thing on Saturday that it should be a complete way of life. You can't put non-violence on for a day and say, well, today we're going to make a statement about Trident and do it in a peaceable sort of way because we feel this would be good for publicity. Non-violence, the whole non-violence training was Christianity, but they disguised it. They didn't want to call it that. For example, before we went on the march, we had what they called a centering down. It felt very American. And a moment search for your personal peace. And that was just, say, a prayer for a minute, for heaven's sake, and they called it centering down to personal peace. That was great.
That is a Quaker phrase.
Is it? Yes. Centering down to personal peace.
Centering down is what Quakers do
before
the meeting. So they didn't make that up.
Yeah.
They were very Quaker.
Okay, I like that. I was thinking it was very American. And also they presented civil disobedience as a real and very necessary option. It wasn't something I considered very much before. It causes a sensation when people get arrested. But since I've come back from Trident, I've begun reading some more Thoreau and Gandhi, and have put the whole thing in a perspective that I'd like to try and explain to you a little bit, just I mean, you will probably all know it anyway, but I'm just rehearsing it for myself. One of the best ways I've thought to try and share this with you would be to read some quotes from people who are more eloquent than me. I've got a few bits from Gandhi here which I thought I'd share with you. This is about, it's a book edited by Merton, and this chapter is called Principles of Nonviolence. I'll just read little tiny, like one or two liners, just to try and explain what nonviolence is. Nonviolence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in your heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being. If one is to combat the fetish of force, it will only be by one means, totally different from those in vogue among pure worshippers of brute force. If one does not practice nonviolence in one's personal relations with others, but hopes to use it in bigger affairs, one is vastly mistaken. Mutual forbearance is not nonviolence. Immediately you get the conviction that nonviolence is the law of life. Then you have to practice it towards those who act violently towards you. And the law must apply to nations as well as to individuals. If the conviction is there, the rest will follow. Nonviolence, which is a quality of heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. So all this stuff was suddenly being thrust at us. We thought we'd gone to protest about a submarine, and suddenly you're being told to turn your world upside down and ask, why are we living in such a violent society? How are we going to sanction a government which spends the money that we earn in building weapons that are going to kill everybody else? Which brings me on also to the civil disobedience. Thoreau was one of the early proponents of that. And although he wasn't quoted directly, a lot of the stuff that was written in the Trident notebook obviously came from his writing. And again, I'll just read a couple of those to you. Preaching against civil disobedience, or preaching against an injustice, doesn't help. You have to act. Imagine the wave of sanity. This isn't from her, in fact, this is from someone else. This is from John Nelson, I think. He was saying, imagine what an impact it would make if USA, if the states, 1 year decided that they'd call a moratorium to the building of any kind of weapon, and instead they would donate that money to some world fund for the development of whatever, third world countries or world health or world hunger. And then they would also challenge other nations to do the same. Imagine the impact that would have as opposed to building bigger and better weapons. He just flung that out, and that stuck with me. I remember that too. And then from Thoreau, he tried to bring out the helplessness of the systems. He just completely distrusted the government because it negated the personal integrity of the people within the country that was being governed. He puts here, he questions the fairness of majority rule. Can there not be a government in which majorities do not virtually decide right and wrong, but conscience? Why has every man a conscience then? I think we should be men first, women, people first, and subjects afterwards. It is not so much desirable to cultivate a respect for the law, so much as a respect for right. That came home to me a lot. We tend to think that so long as we vote for the party that we think will do the job, it isn't our fault if that party doesn't get in. We've done our bit. Majority rule. This whole bit about consensus brings in the same bit, that we have to be individually responsible for the society in which we live. And I felt that a great deal before I came to the States. I was living in Brighton, which is a south coast town, and has lots of alcoholics who end up there just because if you have to sleep out, it's one of the warmest parts of England to sleep out in. And I got to know quite a few of them. And it made me realise that I was living in a country that tolerated and harassed and caused people to have to live this kind of life, and I wasn't doing anything about it. And my very inactivity was sanctioning it. And I was horror-struck, and I was quite glad to escape to the States so I could forget it for a while and face it when I go back. So I'd begun thinking along these lines before I came here, and this, I don't know, it's just like shedding a huge big beam on a whole lot of thoughts that are going around in my mind. And the whole point about going on a demonstration is that it's all very well having these feelings and smugly feeling that, oh yes, nuclear weapons are wrong and I agree, and we're all quite proud of that. Awful. So when Leo Busick comes up here and says how good nuclear power is, you know, we all take a deep breath and shock, horror, reaction. He likes nuclear power. Isn't that also meaning he likes nuclear weapons? But unless we're prepared to act about what we believe, then in a way it almost negates our feelings about that. And again, John Nelson has said some things about that. Fine, again. Yeah, this is Thoreau again. Or even Martin Luther King once said, I think someone else quoted this, people who violate immoral laws and accept the penalties are showing the highest respect for the law. Practically speaking, the opponents to a reform in Massachusetts, this is Thoreau about trying to change the slave laws in Massachusetts at the time he was writing. Practically speaking, opponents to a reform in Massachusetts are not the 100,000 politicians in the South, but 100,000 merchants and farmers here who are more interested in commerce and agriculture than in humanity. Thoreau complains that men are full of opinions and complaints, but they don't do anything in earnest. Even voting isn't doing something. Under a government which imprisons anyone unjustly, the true place for a just man is in prison. Again, that was Thoreau speaking, and he himself was in prison, and that is particularly pertinent for this case here. I get John's point about the trespass law, that it's kind of picky, it doesn't have the right impact. But to me that wasn't so important because it provided an arena for learning. Just gathering 3,000 people together and teaching them all this stuff is worth that kind of action, I think. A government to be purely just, this again is Thoreau, must have the sanction and consent of the governed. It can have no pure right over my person and property, but what I concede to it. Again, don't just accept what the government gives you. Think through everything that's being put to you and you're being told to do about it. This is Gandhi. He has some beautiful things to say about nonviolence. In nonviolence, bravery consists in dying, not in killing. That one I liked a lot. True nonviolence not only implies the highest form of bravery, it is a kind of charismatic gift, a creed and a passion for which one sacrifices everything. It is a complete way of life in which, I can't pronounce that word, I just say nonviolence.
Satyagraha.
In other words, one who is consecrated to nonviolence, to the nonviolent defense of truth, is totally dedicated to the transformation of his own life and that of his adversary and of his society by means of love. False nonviolence is a weak policy of passive protest or a cloak for impotent hatred which doesn't dare to use force. It is without love and it seeks harm in other ways by sabotage or terrorism. Gandhi would prefer an honest resort to force than a false kind of nonviolence, because those who can't practice dedicated nonviolence should defend their rights by force. He doesn't preach a passive surrender of rights or of human dignity, but he asks you to be totally honest in whatever approach you choose to take. And surely if you're going to want a society where there is no violence, as someone mentioned before, you should go about it in a nonviolent way. Somewhere here there's a beautiful quote, and I have lost it for now, but I should find it. Another thing that struck me was, as I mentioned a bit before, the similarity between Christianity and nonviolence, which again, shock, horror, have to rethink a lot of things again, because in a way the nonviolent gospel, if you like, is as radical as the Christian gospel, in that if you want to accept nonviolence as a way of life, it means that you're going to constantly have to battle the way of life as we know it on earth, in the way that if you want to be a radical Christian, you've got to be constantly battling all the accepted norms. Was it John yesterday gave an example of how you can look at the world and say, or look at a castle and say, look what a wonderful castle man has built. But if you're really going to look at it from a Christian perspective or a radical perspective, you stand on your head and say, isn't it wonderful that God hasn't dropped us yet? It involves that complete reversal of concepts, and that's why I'm finding it difficult to explain, because they haven't sunk into me completely yet. And also that brings up a great number of fears. And to answer Don's question, one of the fears would be the economics of changing such a system. Yeah, we're spending $2 billion on building a Trident submarine. But is that really the way you want to spend it? That isn't the only option. And that was the exciting part about the notion of peace conversion, in that this is a book that's quite good too. Again, it's just facts and figures. I don't know how accurate they are. But it says, weapon production today actually means loss of jobs, not a gain of jobs, because $1 billion could create 76,000 military jobs, or 100,000 construction jobs, or 139,000 care jobs, healthcare jobs, or 187,000 education jobs. You don't have to look at it in a negative way. You can be positive and find work that isn't going to destroy a person's integrity or humanity, if that makes any sense. I mean, come back on me for that. Then there's a big fear about, say we stop producing our arms before the enemy. What if the enemy then doesn't play the game and says, well, boo and snubs, you've got rid of your bombs and whatnot, now we're going to come over and bash you on the head. Boo and snubs. But what are we trying to protect? Are we trying to protect our fridges and our microwave ovens and our standard of living? You can't destroy the people, you can't destroy the person, unless by killing them. And if you're really going to be an honest person, isn't it better to die honest than live dishonestly? I just question the whole fear that I have about needing to protect myself physically from something else.
Jim, when John Nelson was here, that was one of the things that Bill Dirks brought up, that we should be aware that if we are going to live a non-violent lifestyle and stop making bombs and submarines, that we are opening up ourselves to, you know, to some kind of, you know, onslaught, that, you know, that is a possibility, and just to be aware of that, and that,
yeah,
that can be kind of a freeing thing.
I felt that too, because if you recognize what it is that you're trying to protect, what it is about the way that we live which is different about the way we think an enemy might live, it'll come down to some fairly picky things. And how can we presume to suppose that whatever enemy it is going to make us live such horribly inhuman lives that it's going to make it worth our living with the inhumanity we now have? I don't see the conflict that much between those two.
I don't know for sure, but I agree 100% with what you say, but I again disagree with blaming it on the pleasures of life that we're trying to protect. I don't want a war to start because of my children. I don't want my children to suffer. You know, I don't care about material value, but I think there's more than that, and I think it's honest. I mean, I think it's more honest for me to say that I don't want the enemy to come over here because of my children. I really don't care about the material things, but I think there are things that we value. I don't want to see you suffer. I don't want to suffer, I guess. I don't want my children to suffer. And I think there are countries that are suffering now, and they don't have material things to defend.
But do you think that's going to happen? Do you think by our having a stockpile of weapons, the idea of war is less likely?
Well,
with less weapons, there'd be less
chance. I'm not sure. I really don't know.
Yeah.
I really wish the United States would try what you say, and, you know, for a year, you know, not put any money into weapons and take that chance. I think, you know, it would be a tremendous witness to the world to do that. But what I was objecting to is you're, you know, blaming the arms race on the materialism. Now, maybe for some people that is the justification. For me, it isn't. So I have to react against that.
Yeah, I didn't mean to make it so narrow. I'm sorry. I was just trying to question a fear which I know I would have as to what's at stake anyway.
Because I think that it's, you know, I think this is one of the things that we give thanks for our government, that we can sit here in security, you know, and try to make the world better.
What kind of security?
Well, the security that our government gives us. We have the right to worship where we want to. We have the right to protest. Mm-hmm. I mean, the very fact that, now there are countries where you couldn't have done what
sure.
you did and really got a lot out of it and are giving us a lot. So I think that's one of the things that we give thanks for, a government that, with all the faults, still, you know, says we have freedom to do that.
Someone made the point during the demonstration, which was really good, and they said that we're protesting not only to the American government to question its arms race, but we're protesting on behalf of those who aren't allowed to protest, which I thought was mm-hmm. very good and very eloquent way to put it. Another thing that I find daunting is you feel so futile. There you are, one of 3,000 at a tiny demonstration in Nowheresville, Washington. And what's that going to do? And something that Thoreau put here, which has helped me anyway, it is not so important that many should be as good as you, not saying that we're good, as that there should be some absolute goodness somewhere, for that will leaven the whole lump. I thought that was quite exciting, just the thought that even one thought somewhere is better than no thought nowhere. The virtues of mercy, non-violence, love and truth in any man can be truly tested only when they are pitted against ruthlessness, violence, hate and untruth. And by that I'm saying that the only way we can test the way we're thinking is when, in Dan's turn, the crunch comes. And therefore you should, in a way you should seek a crunch and not fear it. I won't bore you with going on that one. Self-respect and honor cannot be protected by others. They are for each individual, himself or herself, to guard. In other words, let's not just rest on our weapons, let's look to ourselves. Maybe you can see what I'm getting at. I just got an awful lot out of the whole thing, and let's open it up.
I'm going to do a very bad thing. I'm going to make a plug for Wendell Berry now. What you just said there about having your own integrity, taking responsibility rather than trusting somebody else to defend that or to create it, or to create it and defend it, so that finally you're not responsible for anything except sitting in front of the television or whatever you choose to do. Letting the experts take care of it is a way of life, he says, for us in this country. And he discusses that quite a bit in his book.
Don, do you want to come back?
Well, yeah. As long as it's all over with. In my own opinion, I think this protest thing is, you have your right to protest, but to do it knowingly breaking the law I don't think that's quite right. If you guys want to protest, fine. But why do we have to break the law? I mean, just to get the glory out of it, you're breaking the law.
No, we're questioning the integrity of the law.
Well, okay. But don't we all kind of agree that the law is the law of the land and we should all go by it? That's just my one little opinion.
Alan, could I clarify something? You didn't break the law.
No.
There's only the fire that stayed on the left side of the road.
Okay, but somebody broke the law.
Yeah.
That was the deal for being there.
No. That's what some people opted to do.
That's right. They broke the law.
109 out of 3,000.
Yeah. Okay, so somebody broke the law. That was knowing you were going in, you were going to break the law. Somebody did. I don't think that's needed. You can possibly get your point across some other way without breaking the law.
Well, a lot of people thought that too, and that's why not everybody went over the fence.
Okay.
So,
that's fine.
I think when you said, you know, that you thought that perhaps we could agree that the law shouldn't be broken, but I think the point is that we can't agree. All of us can no longer agree that at least that particular law shouldn't be broken. I mean, that's precisely the point. And that's why the law must be broken, to testify to that fact. I mean, if you stand outside this fence and say, we have no respect for this law, where's your integrity then? I mean, if that's the truth, then in truth, you have to go ahead and do that act.
or otherwise you're just a windbag.
Breaking the law is asking you, the whole idea of breaking the law is to put in perspective the fact that the law is not God. The law is supposed to be an aid. Like with any structure, if any structure hinders you, get rid of it. If, as Merton said, saying your prayers interferes with praying, get rid of your prayers.
All right.
I tried to speak to that before. This is not a perfect, by any means, perfect model for civil disobedience, because the fence around Bangor is not the law that they're upset about.
Okay.
So the breaking of the law does not fit what they want to say. Some people, apparently, their point of frustration is such they do not think that they're being heard on being anti-nuclear, and chose, instead of just a protest, to also have the further publicity. I even said they could be accused more easily of being publicity hounds. I don't think it's an ego trip. I don't know them all. I know it was not bad for John Nelson. He's the only one I know. To also then have a day in court at which you speak further, perhaps get more publicity, get on TV, which he did, and last night was in a panel in Spokane with Senator Jackson and a retired military admiral and the head of World Without War, getting more people conscious of the issue. If it was clearer that it was an unjust law in your mind, again, that's a matter of opinion, it would be easier then to justify the civil disobedience than in this case. I guess I haven't said it well yet. It's very American to dump tea off a boat, a British boat. It's a Boston Tea Party. That's as American as our history, because we thought that was unjust. It was not as clear to go in and pour blood on a Davenport in the White House. You know what people thought? They thought those hippies were tearing up property. What Berrigans wanted to say, I knew most of those people. They wanted to say the White House has gotten out of proportion. We have made it a temple. Nixon wanted to put imperial hats on his guards. I have a picture, I saved it for a while, of what Nixon wanted to make. He wanted to be a king. He was supposed to be in tipped on, he was in bad shape. I really think that's true. Some people thought it was getting so bad that in order to make sure we didn't make it a temple, they would do an act of desecrating the temple. Smile. It never came across. People did not hear that. People did not understand blood in the White House. They didn't get their message. And I admit that they didn't. It was too muddled. What I tried to say before is the fence at Bangor doesn't do it so clearly that nobody can miss the message. So in a sense, I agreed with your first comment that in this case, why break the law? If you got your message across by walking down the street and got a chance to share, got 100 opportunities like this one because of that weekend, that's really the prime thing that they were doing.
I think that's the reason there was such a strong reaction to the claim that Trident, in this room, that Trident is a first strike weapon. Because if Trident is a first strike weapon, if we have to deal with that, then it might be justified. And that's the claim, of course.